Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies, and on Tech and Trees, I talk to climate tech founders, investors, and operators to learn about how we can build better climate tech companies and how we build more of them faster. On this episode, I talk to Florian Hildebrand, co-founder and CEO of Greenlight Carbon Technologies. Greenlight is a direct air capture company that draws down carbon from the air while producing hydrogen. They have raised $10 million in capital so far and want to grow as fast as Tesla did. Ambitious goals, but if we want to fight climate change effectively, we need people thinking big. Continue listening to find out how Florian wants to reach Tesla-scale success with Greenlight Carbon Technologies. Hi, Florian. How are you doing today?
Good. Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. I would like to start with this very short conversation starter. That is like, what's the last aha moment that you have had while building Greenlight?
The last aha moment when building Greenlight? I think the last aha moment probably was when, so I think when we started the company, we were all about, you know, speed and urgency. And I think everything that we do in climate tech has to have a sense of urgency because the time is just so pressing. And we thought that probably it's going to take a little bit longer to go to market with our technology. But then this was pulled forward massively by probably 18 months. And I think this was the first aha moment to realize how much is happening in that space, that people are willing to also on the customer side take the risks to, you know, buy into this early stage technology.
Yeah, got it. I'd like to directly talk about like what you're doing at Greenlight. And short, very, very short, basic summary. Greenlight draws down carbon via direct air capture while producing hydrogen, right? And that sounds a bit like hitting two birds with one stone. But after hearing this very basic summary, and I hope it doesn't dump down what you do, could you pitch Greenlight to me the way you would pitch an investor?
Yeah, I think it just starts what pretty much what you said. So if you look at the climate crisis, it becomes clear that, of course, we have to reduce emissions. But even if we manage to do that, there will always be this massive amount of CO2 left in the atmosphere that we have to take out. And without scaling that industry and like the ability as humanity to take out CO2 from the atmosphere, we have no chance of any sustainable future. So it's really important to do that. But it's extremely challenging because CO2 is with 0.04%, just such a small fraction of the atmosphere, really. And so when you want to take it out, it requires a lot of energy. And then, so the core question about how can you actually scale carbon dioxide removal and taking CO2 off the atmosphere is, first of all, how can you bring down the energy? So you need less energy. And the second part is, where does the energy come from? So our technology is one of the only few technologies in the world that with the co-product of hydrogen, we massively reduce the amount of energy that needs to be associated to the CO2 because the total system has some of the energy value to the hydrogen, which is obviously a valuable product. And secondly, we can run the process completely in renewables because we can switch it on and off, but still having a constant flow of uptake of carbon. And we believe this makes our technology scalable anywhere in the world. And because of the hydrogen, extremely cheap. And this will be hopefully our success to bring this into the market.
Sounds a bit like a magic trick or a kind of magic fix to all the problems of the AC. And I'm kind of, that's why I would like to talk to you about the technology behind the process overall. But I would actually like to go a step deeper because behind the technology that you're deploying, right, there are 15 years of research, if my research is correct, right? And you basically found the way you found your co-founder or one of your co-founders, right? Like I read that you basically emailed 100 different scientists and asked them about like the technology that they're researching. So first of all, I would like to kind of talk to you, like to know from you, what steps did you take from deciding to work on climate to actually founding Greenlight? Like how did you go about this technology search? You know what I mean?
Yeah, so I had a company or co-founded a company before, which we scaled quite large, you know, 8-digit revenues, 120 people. And I did that for 5 years as co-CEO. And then over time, I took my wife, like when COVID came and everybody had to work from home, we took our Tesla and we drove across Europe 2 years in a row and just sort of, you know, worked from anywhere and spent a week somewhere in Spain, Italy, and so on, and just drove around and experienced the essentially the continent. And we really saw, I think these were like really, really hot summers, you know, the lakes were drying out and you could really like see climate change happening. And that, I think, started to shift my focus in terms of, I just started thinking more about, okay, how can we turn the previous business into a climate, you know, positive climate impact business? But I think you cannot just change your business model and just do climate from, like, you know, I think that obviously needs to be a foundation for that. So I realized that probably I needed to do something else because I really wanted to work on the problem. And then sort of, you know, at one point I decided to leave the company and I wanted to do something in climate tech. And I really started, I think, sort of, you know, on a white piece of paper where I wrote down my own hypothesis of sort of how I see the world, how I would sort of look at mankind. And I think that probably as humans, we're a little bit selfish and we will not change. And I think for sure this sort of, you know, just not flying anymore and not buying stuff anymore, unfortunately, that's really not an option for the masses. So I think we need to obviously create the regulation and the politics to drive that. And I think especially the CO2 price is a really important factor for this. But also I think we need engineered solutions. And that's what I thought. And then I sort of ended up, I created this mirror board and I ended up with like the card, which said I wanted to have a company well funded that has the capacity to reduce 100 megatons of CO2 per year. And then I walked my way backwards. And the first thing I did was I started to network. So I reached out to lots of founders and investors in that space. I made a few business angel investments in this space, invested in a fund and just started to get really close to the ecosystem and sort of, I think, be relevant. I think when you reach out to lots of people and you sort of have like no value other than that you had a company before and you don't know what you want to do next, I think that's a little bit difficult. So I thought, you know, potentially if I can somehow engage in the ecosystem by investing, that's maybe the first step. And then eventually I thought I really want to go back to the operator side. And I thought, so I think like when you build a software, like the previous business, it was very clear that, you know, the hypothesis from investors was always, okay, you're going to be able to do that technologically wise. But the question is there a market? And I think in climate tech, it's very clear what we have to do. And it's also very clear what the market is going to look like. The question is, can we actually do it? And with which technologies? So I think it's a little bit easier to work your way backwards because you can know you want to address, I don't know, emissions reductions, you know, batteries and so on, or you want to like direct, you know, negative emissions. So I sort of created this map for what I wanted to do. And then I reached out to lots of researchers. And I would say, now telling the story now, it sounds like it was all structured and there was this sort of master plan that I followed. But obviously you just go along and you sort of think about, okay, what could be the next steps and how can I get one step closer to the goal? And then I thought, okay, probably, you know, if I want to build a hardware company with some deep tech, then I'm not going to be able to just make that up, right? So I need research. And I think in Germany, especially where we have good researchers, but I think we struggle to really put innovation into the market and into the economy. And when you look at where deep tech companies are coming from, then there's just a few universities which really stick out, you know, stand out, and the rest is just, yeah, I think they have some room to grow. So I thought, you know, probably like 95% of the universities in Germany, they're probably going to be a little bit more receptive because they don't have that ecosystem. And that's how I then started to reach out. And then I started to speaking to all these people. And I'm a mechanical engineer by training, but obviously, you know, the last years I worked as, you know, an entrepreneur, much more on the business side. So I looked at all the labs and just talked to these people, and they're all telling me, you know, I have this great idea, which is absolutely going to change the world. And it's 10 times better than what anybody else has done, which is what pretty much what anybody tell you who you're asking in climate tech. We've got the best idea and it's 10 times better than what anybody else does. But I was in that challenge that now I'm like, okay, you know, I understand sort of the basics, but how can I judge, right? So the next challenge that I had then was like, I need somebody to sort of help me do the due diligence. And I had a very good connection to Earlybird. So I would then sort of, you know, exchange ideas and talk to them to see how have they looked at the market. And I think the basic question was, if I would do this tomorrow, would you invest? And so this helped me to sort of navigate a little bit more of the space. And then I think when I met Peter in Essen, who sort of, now Peter is the guy who invented the technology, as you sort of mentioned, and he's sort of this, I would say, climate scientist by heart. So he started working on the ozone hole 30 years ago. And then he was always in that phase, like sort of how, you know, molecules are uptaken into liquids. And that's sort of something related to the ozone hole, but also something related to how you absorb CO2. It's sort of the molecular reaction is, I think, on that term, so similar. So he was like very, very much deep into the molecule basis. And so 15 years ago, he transitioned into carbon capture, and he led quite large projects, over 20 million in research money, where he was sort of tasked with the challenge, how can you take CO2 out of flue gases to prolongate the lifetime of coal plants? So I met Peter, and he's of transition, but I'll come back to that. But so I met Peter, and I was quite impressed with him. And then I looked at sort of, so he told me his story of what he was working on. And he early on understood that we have to take CO2 out of the atmosphere, but that this is like extremely challenging because it requires so much energy. And I think when you speak to most of the climate companies and energy intensive processes, I think the basic answer is always, yeah, we're just going to use renewables. But I think the question is like, how do you use them and where and what exactly does that mean for your whole operating model? I think that's sort of less answered, especially in the early stages. And I think I saw glimpses of at least having some consideration of that. So, yeah, I then just looked at it. And once I sort of almost understood everything, I thought, yeah, this is the right thing to do. And then the next part was, okay, now we have this, you know, great technology, the great scientists. Of course, we need to build a team around it. And it was clear that the two of us alone will not be able to do that. So we needed like a strong operator who can, you know, run the team and drive the development and so on. And this is how Nicholas, our third co-founder, got involved. And then, so that sort of, that was the team complete. So I reached out to him and I met him a few years ago. And then sort of the last question was, how can we get the IP into the company? And luckily there we had some, you know, support from the university. There was this one guy who was an entrepreneur before, and he was like, yeah, just like, you have to do it. Let's find a way. And then we found this fast way. And then I think sort of we had everything ready. We sort of had the investors lined up. We had a great founding team. We had some, you know, early talent from the university, and we had the IP together, which allowed us to then start running. And that's how we then created the company. So the answer was a little bit longer, and but I thought, yeah, maybe to elaborate a little.
No, I'm happy that you went in depth with that, because it's an interesting story. And you know, I only read this one line. Okay, Florian emailed 100 different scientists and basically selected one IP. And I think that was probably a bit too much of a superficial answer. So I'm happy that you elaborated. One follow-up question I'd like to ask though is, how did you go about not only, you know, picking the technology? I think you touched on that enough, but how did you go about dating your co-founders? Because I mean, if I look at your two co-founders, especially, let's say the science guy on your team, right? There's quite an age difference, I would say, between you guys. So what kind of, let's say, values or other factors did you have to align on with your co-founders to be sure, okay, we can be the right team to build this company?
I think, you know, first of all, it's obviously the personal impression. And I mean, Nicholas and myself, we met in 2017. So there was some base level of trust and understanding. And I think we had a high appreciation for each other. And we started to early on, especially with Nicholas, to create these documents of responsibility of how we see the company. We spent a lot of time in the lab. But ultimately, it was still a decision taken on, you know, a couple of weeks of experience, right? And that does not, you know, replace years of experience. But I think it's about, you know, finding a common ground. And I think so in the beginning, we said we have to build a football team with, you know, really, really strong players. And we need to have sort of Messi playing next to Ronaldo. And that's just how we approached hiring. I think now we went a little bit back to this sort of, probably it's more a football team. It's also larger. But eventually it was like, what are the best roles that we can play on the pitch? And like us founders, but obviously also the team, but also the three of us. And I think from my sort of, you know, time off doing something else, I also had a lot of like personal reflection. And I think one thing that was very clear to me that I need to be very, very aware of what I'm good at and especially what I'm not good at. And for these areas, I think it's important to get people in there. And then I think we need to build the operating system that works for us. And I think as a team, you know, Peter is obviously, he's like above 60 years old. So he is not the same entrepreneur as sort of Nicholas and myself, right? He's not used to building companies. I mean, he's used to like, you know, developing stuff and thinking about that. He's not the guy to create roadmaps. So we knew that probably, you know, the strategic side of things is not going to come from him. So that's something we really sort of need to play his strengths into the equation. then Niklas is an absolutely great operator who can sort of manage large teams. So that was sort of clear. And I think I'm a little bit maybe stronger on the sales side. So that's how we then split the organization and said, probably Niklas is going to carry the majority of the team. Peter is going to have probably a very, very, very small team. And I'm going to have sort of a middle-sized team. And then sort of, stepping out of the egos, we need to do what's best for the company now. And I think that's how we sort of approached it in the beginning. And then we reiterated. And I think it's a lot of, learning, giving each other regular feedback. But I think eventually, you can do so much due diligence, but in the interest of time and like when you also have to take a decision, there's also, a remainder of risk. But luckily in our case, it played out.
Yeah, no, it makes sense to me. Let's talk about like how you're building and scaling the company, right? And like one thing I'd like to talk to you about is something that I heard from another tech entrepreneur. He's Martin Freimüller, who was also on the podcast. He's building Octavia Carbon, a DAC company in Kenya, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know him or have heard of him.
I know him. But we spoke on the phone, actually. I got married in Kenya. And we spoke on the phone. He was in Nairobi and I was in Mombasa.
Ah, amazing. Well, in that case, like he told me that he sees DAC as a bit of a manufacturing challenge rather than a technology challenge. So he kind of compared building a DAC station, let's put it this way. He compared that to manufacturing cars and that we need to basically build the massive infrastructure needed to manufacture DAC, DAC at scale. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I would probably agree to like 50%. But I think the first step is the technology challenge. And I think the stuff out there that can be deployed is, I think, not the stuff that we need in terms of technological innovation. So I think in DAC, you sort of see these like two waves. Wave one, which is like, the sort of Climeworks, Global Thermostats type of businesses that were launched 10, 15 years ago on technology, which I think is inferior to what DAC Wave 2 is building. And that's like companies like, Mission Zero, Repair, ourselves, and then, a few others. Probably like Carbon Atlantis from Munich as well. So Caneo. I mean, a few of these companies who are now popping up who are sort of, I think, approaching the DAC challenge a little bit more radical and a little bit on this, like, sort of, these technologies probably have the potential to reduce the energy sort of by 5 to 10x. And I think that's needed. And I think the people that are sort of prematurely or like scaling right now, I think they're sort of a little based on old technology. I think you need to do that if you want to bring down the cost. And you can see that the legacy players, they're struggling to bring down the costs of the per ton of CO2. So I think that is a technological challenge. And we have like our master plan is essentially three steps. So step one is we need to show it's economically viable in the next, 3 to 5 years. And we need to create a business case in not just carbon sequestration, which is today still philanthropic capital, with a big, big green premium. I think we need to case in something like where CO2 is actually creating a business value. And I think sustainable aviation fuel is super interesting for that. I think that's step one. And that's your sort of route to bankability. And then I think sort of in parallel or after that, you need to think about how do you turn your company into a platform. And we had a team offsite last year. And if you look at what we have to achieve, then sort of we have to grow 1 million X in 20-ish years. And we have to build thousands of these facilities, right? Once we're ready. So the only company that managed to do that is Tesla in the last, the only hardware company that managed to grow 1 million X. So we have to do what Tesla has done. So absolutely, it's extremely critical to think about supply chain, to think about your production strategy, and to think about which parts you need to do in-house and where you can rely on suppliers. Because some of the stuff that, and that's probably where I would agree, like sort of the hardware that we're building, at least on the front end, I think probably anybody can do that. There's like no tolerances, something is very similar. I think the way you run the chemistry and the control and so on, that's extremely complex. And that's our IP and know-how. But I think the hardware is simple. But on the back end itself, I would say the hardware is more complex and you probably need production know-how as well. So I could see us sort of, doing the first part with lots of partners out there and then sort of just producing the second part and some of the chemistry. But yeah, absolutely. And then it becomes this production and supply chain, because then it's about like, how do you deploy? How do you get sort of access to unlimited capital that allows you to really, really scale? And how can you sort of essentially create network effects in hardware, but I would fundamentally agree that it's not a technological challenge. I think it is a technological challenge. And also, if you look at like the Climeworks and stuff, who are probably, you know, super far in their journey, I think they still have a massive amount of challenges to really run their plants consistently.
Interesting take. Let's talk about the business case that you mentioned, because I mean, you're also, as you mentioned, more on the commercial side for Greenlight, right? And when I talked to Martin, right, he told me that he thinks the way he is deploying DAC in Kenya makes a lot of sense because, well, overall, you need a lot of manufacturing or engineering talent that is just comes at a lot lower cost in Kenya, right? And he basically said, okay, in Europe, engineering talent comes at so high cost that it should just be deployed at scale, basically, or let's say craftsman talent to kind of revamp the whole heating, insulation infrastructure, and so on and so forth of the whole building stack here, basically. So I'd like to know, like, what kind of business case are you looking at? Like, how do you plan to commercialize? Where do you think are, the growth pockets for you in the future?
Yeah, like the story he has to tell. And I'm really impressed, like, what he's done, like moving to Kenya. I think the guts and stuff, I think that's just, you know, absolutely impressive. I would probably say that I think we need to have companies like Octavia who sort of show it's done in the global south. And I think we need to rethink that. But I would also say that I agree that there's lots of talent, but I think, you know, if you look at the experience and the infrastructure and so on, it's probably still a little bit easier to do it in Europe. Also, if you look at in the US, if you look at the sort of Western societies. So I think sort of the access to engineering talent, if you look at a lot of the process challenges that we have, like we are based in Essen, which is sort of the previous heart of industrial Germany. We've got all the energy companies, chemical companies, all these people who are solving similar challenges in different industries, but on the process level, very similar processes in completely different applications. So I think you have the people who can make things faster, even though that they're more expensive. But hopefully this is like, you know, a matter of like then getting speed as well. I think that's like, how do we also show them to work? And then in terms of the business model, I don't think that these businesses, like the plants in general, are going to be deployed massively here in Europe. I mean, maybe in the south of Europe for sure, and maybe in some of the wind regions. But yeah, I think the sort of massive deployment will happen in the global south, right? It will happen in areas like Kenya, which is super advanced. And I was like, part of my wedding trip was also to explore the dark side of things there. So I think Kenya has been on our list for a really long time. And actually we signed an MOU now also with a company, you know, in Kenya. Actually, there's a second one coming now. But I don't think you need to be in Kenya to do that. I think Martin for sure will have the talent, and I think there will be some advantages there. But hopefully we can just build a better tech, or, you know, also an outstanding tech. But the market will be large enough, right? But that's how I look at it a little bit.
Yeah. How do you plan to commercialize? Because you mentioned a sustainable aviation fuel, right? Like, is that what you're interested in mainly as your target market to sell to? Or like, what are you thinking of?
Yeah. So I think, that the answer that everybody has is, hey, let's do carbon credits and let's do negative emissions. And I think that's what most people say. And I think the market for negative emissions, I think it will grow, it will be more important, but it's still sort of today small, and it's also driven by, you know, essentially it's philanthropy, right? And so it is a market which is growing, but I think just because everybody is going there, I think we thought, okay, let's just sort of see if we can sort of avoid going there in the first step. And maybe there are other ways to sort of accelerate it. And I think if you look at CO2, there are generally a lot of applications, like what we can do with CO2, like, you know, from dry ice production to fuels to chemicals. And I think it's rather finding sort of your niche market where the technology sort of makes sense. I think like Nicholas, our co-founder, he always says, look, a little bit like, you know, where do you sort of build your Tesla Roadster, and who's the customer, which is in this case, the tech entrepreneur to seem cooler driving an electric car, which at that time didn't work so much. And I think that's sort of what we need to find as well. So we're spending a lot of time on that. And then this can potentially fund sort of your development journey over the next couple of years. And then I think it's essentially about how do you build a business model which allows you to reach the scale. And doing everything in-house and producing it in-house is probably not going to be it. So there's going to be a level of licensing. There's going to be a level of operating own plants and fabricating own plants, and there's going to be a level of potentially just selling stuff and letting other people operate it. But I think this we will have to find out over time.
Yeah, interesting. I read online, and again, like, tell me if you don't want to go into it too much, but that currently your facilities are somewhere in a higher six-figure range in terms of price. I don't know if that has changed, if that has is from in like all the source or whatever, but I would actually like to ask you, what does the, for a very early stage company like you, what does the sales process for such facilities look like? You know what I mean? Like, who are the customers or profiles that you're looking for, and what, how do you engage them?
I think so. I don't think that direct sales in our case makes so much sense right now. I think there are a few, like the frontier funds, I think there are a few sort of go-to places where you can go if you want to have some multiplying effect. Obviously, it also depends what you do. If you want to sell a facility or carbon credits, I mean, carbon credits is sort of a, can even be a B2C game, right? So if you think about, you know, selling facilities, I think like we at least, and I think that's probably similar to some other companies as well, you get a lot of inbound traction, people sort of asking for stuff and wanting to learn more. And I think you have to be smart about understanding who to talk to and where do you want to spend your time. So I think that it's important that you develop a process which allows you to find that out very, very fast. And that's sort of, you know, essentially in the first call already say, okay, you know, let's do a contract in 2 weeks. And then people would say, I just want to find out. I want to learn more. But yeah, what do you want to find out? Like, what's your motivation? And are you prepared to buy or not? And I think sort of moving that conversation very fast from, hey, let's, I want to learn more about the stuff towards like, what is your commercial? Like, what do you want to do? And how can we help you? And let's talk about the contract already today. I think then this shifts and accelerates, or at least allows you to focus better. That's how we try to do it.
So what are the motivations why people want to work with you? Or like, what were your like aha moments to talk about them and to recircle back to the beginning when you realized, okay, these are the drivers behind potential demand?
Yeah, I think there's like two drivers. So the first, I think it's what we sort of, the theme for DAC in general is like the philanthropic need. And, you know, Deep Sky in Canada is a great example. So they're probably the largest DAC storage and project developer right now. But they just buy technologies to find out which of these would work and then how can they actually start sequestering, you know, gigatons of CO2. I think that's very straightforward. And I think Kenya has a similar model now where they just try to find out what works and just start to get going. I think that's one part where they just want to test technologies. And then so philanthropic carbon credits. And then the second part is companies which are product developers, which are today developing projects that will potentially run for the next 20, 30 years, like in the alternative fuel space or in chemicals, where they already have today have the challenge to think about where is their carbon feedstock coming from. And with, you know, ammonia production less from methane and so on. So these projects are also in a way exploring early stage DAC technologies, because that's just mission critical for them, because they know that in 10, 15 years, biomass recycling is not going to be enough anymore. And I think that's the motivation to buy stuff,
yeah,
or explore stuff.
Yeah. Looking at the challenge that you're working on and to what extent you want to scale, you mentioned this figure 1 million X, right? And that Tesla has been the only company who achieved that. Have you had any like, oh fuck moments in terms of, you know, this is so huge. Like, however, are we ever going to do this? And if yes, like, how do you deal with these kind of moments, maybe?
I think in general, if you look at the scale and the amount of challenges that you have, you could probably have an oh fuck moment every single day. And you can probably also sort of get lost in the problems and in the challenges that you have. I think in general, it boils down to probably two things, methodology and team. And I think the first is important that you sort of have this, and Niklas is really, really, really strong on that. To make sure that we can sort of, you know, work on 100 challenges at the same time without losing speed and sort of, you know, without sort of dropping the ball. And that I think gives then, and like with that team that we have and making sure we use the right skills. And I think that then gives the team and us the sort of reassurance that yes, obviously not everything is solved, but we're making steady progress. And I think you just have to believe in your own methodology and your own team that needs to work really, really well together. And then you just have to trust and just do the, you know, the best that you can and try to push yourself and then move forward. And I think then you don't have these sort of major oh fuck moments, because there's like a small oh fuck moment every single day, but you know, you sort of just put this into your process, you put this into methodology, and then you know these things are sort of, you know, gradually being worked on. And then you see that, you know, in the sprints we have and the reviews that we're making progress, we're making learnings, and the hours on the test bench are going up, the energy is going down, and you just see that things are moving forward. And
are these oh fuck moments when you overcome them also paired with like hell yeah moments sometimes, or like when you, what, let me ask, phrase it differently, maybe, like what do you think are, where like the last major milestones that you achieved?
Yeah, I think maybe the funniest one is where we would run the desorption and for the first time, that was like a few months ago on a larger scale, and we were a little bit scared because this was essentially, this is where 90% of the energy sits in the system, or 95%. And we had this new system designed, and the first time we switched it on, we had sort of this target in mind of what we wanted to achieve. And we managed to actually be better than that. But when you run the system, it was sort of like super high energy. And then we sort of made some tweaks. And every time we sort of, you know, dropped an order of magnitude in a way, you know, Peter would open a beer and drink the beer because he was so happy. And then, you know, he ended up with like 6-7 beers on that day, and everybody was super happy, and Peter was drunk. So I think this was definitely one of the moments where you would celebrate. But I think in general, so what we do is we try to do this like two week sprints, reviews as well, where we sort of, you know, take all the learnings that we have done over the next 2 weeks, present it to the team and show the results. And we started now to do sort of every single experiment. We sort of put a cost to it. So what would it have costed if this was the technology deployed at the customer premise? What would have been the cost? And I think this sort of helps to, you know, create small parts of successes every 2 weeks, but also challenges.
I very much like that you're putting up that number of what would have been the cost of deployment. Regarding that, do you have, because theoretically when you run a startup, right, best case scenario, every single week will be the best week your company has ever had, right? So theoretically speaking, because you're always developing further, right? But like, I've been part of like a few startups now, and you know, every time there's some kind of leader who needs to motivate their teams, right? And you can't just always say, oh, this week has again been the best week we have had, right? So how do you balance, how do you keep a team motivated without kind of staying too repetitive? How do you motivate a team for the long run? And do you have like any methodology for that, if you know what I'm getting at?
Yeah, I think it comes down again to methodology. And so we are rolling out a new performance management system now. We're running out a new sprint system. And we sort of create this methodology roadmap where every quarter we're introducing a few things, like sort of, you know, starting now with AI and how can we do things faster. And I think this general sense of things are moving forward, I think this is, and the people that join our company, they're not joining, I mean, probably we're paying higher salaries than in Kenya, but it's not that here we would, you know, pay, and I don't mean this sarcastically in any way, just because you mentioned the point there, but, you know, we would still pay lower salaries than what you would probably earn at a corporate here, right? And it's a super risky environment. So people that join, that have kids, families, have to pay, you know, bills for their houses and stuff, they would join already because they want to do it and they have the sort of purpose, right? And I think that's sort of a general sense of motivation, like this baseline motivation. And then I think it's about, you know, celebrating the successes, being clear about the learnings, and just having this, you know, constant way of like, we're moving forward and this is now coming and we looked at that and now we're trying to do this, and just like everything is sort of constantly moving. I think that motivates the people. But yeah, not every week is great, and not every day everybody goes home and is super motivated and super happy, right? We cannot expect that everybody's happy every day. For sure, this is not going to happen. But I think sort of, you know, probably out of 10 days, you nine ones need to be happy. And I think so far this has been going in the right direction. But yeah, there'll probably also be other times. But yeah.
Do you actually, because we're talking about Tesla, right? And like how they were kind of, let's say, partly inspiration for your company or for your journey, right? And they have this very rudimentary, a very basic version of their strategy in terms of it's a three-step process or something, if I remember right. In terms of, you know, step one, build a very expensive sports car, sell it, and then
we have money. That as well.
Yeah. Okay. I was wondering because I mean that also helps to keep people, you know, focused on a goal. Yeah. So I was wondering if you have that.
Yeah, that's I thought of touching on this before. It's like, you know, sort of, you know, showing economic viability in one key vertical, then platformizing the company and then scale if this there was no tomorrow, and in parallel work on levers of scalability, aka supply chain partners and bankability.
Yeah, okay, perfect. I love that. I will actually come to an end here and would just like to ask you one last question, basically. And that one is a bit selfish, but I would again like to circle back to the beginning where we were talking about how you dated your co-founders, right? And if I'm a young founder now today, or a young aspiring founder, let's put it this way, and I want to convince a scientist like Peter on your side to work with me, convince these guys that I'm the right business partner for them, how do I do that?
It's a very good question. I think it comes with authenticity and some form of value that you bring to the table. And I think in my case, it was knowing how to start a company, knowing the process, having it done before, and that created trust, because essentially it's all about trust. And I think when you reach out, I think you need to find that, like, so what is the value that you bring to the table for someone who's worked on this for several years, and why do they need you right now? And I think it's ultimately even a sales situation where you have to sell yourself and create that level of trust. So I think it's sort of working out your own pitch and why you could be beneficial for this specific scenario.
It's a bit like, if you can't sell yourself, pitch yourself. How are you ever going to sell or pitch a company, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Florian, thank you so much for taking the time. This was super insightful for me. So thanks so much. And yeah, I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you very much. And good luck.